Lives of the Unconscious.
Episode 37, Male Perversion and Sexual Violence. When it comes to the topic of perversion, we are always treading on delicate terrain, and for all sorts of reasons. Perversion comes from the Latin word pervertia and means to turn around, to reverse. For a long time, the term was used simply to mean deviating from social norms, turning them upside down. Usually, although not exclusively, it referred to sexual acts or affinities. According to this definition, a perversion would be, for example, when the thing that a person finds sexually arousing is considered taboo or repulsive by social norms. For a long time, homosexuality was deemed a perversion in most societies. And indeed, in many places, it still is. In the end, the battle over the definition of perversion has always been about what is or ought to be normal. And the battle ordinarily plays out right where a society is most easily provoked, sometimes even responding with aggression, namely around sexual desires and preferences. This has often involved employing medicine or psychiatry in order to categorize all manner of deviations as pathological, so that they can ultimately be condemned and persecuted. To categorize that which a person is, for example, their sexual identity, as something abnormal and sick, cuts to the very core of who that person is. It is essentially a linguistic act of annihilation, and historically has often enough been followed by real acts of annihilation. This is partly the reason why the term perversion has been abandoned and replaced by the term paraphilia, Greek for a deviant disposition, whereby problems are rarely solved by merely giving them a new name. Typical forms of perversion, or paraphilia, can be found listed in official diagnostic manuals. Examples include fetishism, exhibitionism, voyeurism, pedophilia, as well as sadism and masochism. But according to current thinking, it is also important to add that one can only say that a preference is pathological if it causes suffering, or presents an acute threat of doing so, be that one's own suffering or that of others. It may well be a departure from the norm for a couple to only enjoy sex when both partners are dressed in latex. This may be a psychologically interesting phenomenon, but unless it causes suffering, it has no clinical significance and is, if you like, none of your damn business. By the same token, one could turn it around and say that perfectly normal sex, neither deviant nor peculiar, almost sounds like a sexual deficiency. Things are quite different, however, when a person's sexual desires are so specific that they amount to a tormenting curse or make interpersonal relationships extremely difficult, such as when they are fixated on a particular object, or when one's sexual appetite is interchangeable with the suffering of others, such as when the only thing that gives a man sexual satisfaction is to expose himself in a frightening way to women without their consent. This is certainly the point at which the line to sexual violence has been crossed. In this episode, we want to explore the psychoanalytic understanding of perversion and the question of whether it can help to shed light on certain forms of sexualized violence. Let's begin by adding that perversion and sexualized violence are not necessarily synonymous. In this episode, we will focus first and foremost on male sexuality and devote a separate episode to forms of female perversion. In psychoanalysis, the concept of perversion has had a long history that cannot be easily summarized, and it remains controversial to this day. Already with Freud, the term played an important role, for example, and his theory of infantile sexuality, in which he described infantile means of experiencing pleasure as polymorphously perverse, by which he meant pleasure derived not from genital stimulation, but rather from other acts or regions of the body, such as the pleasure children experience in holding back or releasing excrement, in showing and looking at themselves, in children's sadistic or masochistic tendencies, but also in the stimulating world of smells, tastes, materials, and forms. For Freud, who was very liberal for his time, such inclinations were a normal part of childhood development, and he observed that adult sexuality proves that they never disappear entirely. Quite the contrary. Polymorphously perverse pleasure may very well be the secret ingredient of adult sexuality. It can possess an almost rebellious potential, for perversion strives for extremes, for making the impossible possible, for allowing the forbidden or the unheard of to happen. To say the least, such sources of pleasure can break the bonds of tedium, which is perhaps why they invariably exert a special, albeit dark, allure from Marquis de Sade to Fifty Shades of Grey. In addition to Freud, some important authors that have contributed to the contemporary psychoanalytic understanding of perversion include Joyce McDougall, Fritz Morgenthaler, Robert Stoller, Janine Chagutsch-Morgell, and Raimund Reiche. Yet in fact, almost every important psychoanalytic scholar has explored the topic in one way or another. Although it would not do justice to the true complexity of the history of the theory of perversion, it may nevertheless be useful to first establish a clinically narrow definition of perversion before moving on to the broader understanding. As we will soon hear, many forms of male sexualized violence, depraved predilections, and seemingly perverse transgressions, catcalling, dick pics, upskirting, the denigration of women, are not necessarily perversions in the narrower sense. The narrower clinical definition of perversion points to the exclusive nature of a particular sexual preference or practice, i.e., those that necessarily require a particular fetish or fetishized practice. In this case, one's sexual life is normally very restricted. There are very few ways to achieve sexual satisfaction or climax. Objects or a particular part of the body may act as a fetish, as when the only thing that causes sexual arousal is a partner's foot, when orgasm or ejaculation is only possible in woman's underwear or pantyhose, or when only certain materials are sexually arousing, like latex, leather, wool, nylon, or certain smells like sweat, excrement, or one's own or someone else's spit. Or sex may involve one particular practice, like exhibitionism, voyeurism, sadism, or masochistic practices. Perversion in this narrow sense means that such objects or practices are not merely forms of play or ways of intensifying pleasure that could just as well be left out, for example, if either partner dislikes them. Perversion means that sex requires a fetishized object or practice, is exclusively and compulsively dependent on it, and leaves almost no room for other forms of sexual expression. Perversion craves to be brought into being and repeated. Much like an addictive substance, one's entire attention, the entirety of one's life, can become beholden to the fetish, albeit not unlike with addiction, usually in secret. During the intimate encounter, the other person and all interpersonal relationships disappear into the background. This may be because the other person is not even needed, or because he or she has become nothing more than an object of sexual gratification, the thing at the other end of the titillating foot, or under the seductive latex, the naked object being tied up, or the female object frightened at suddenly being stripped naked. The perverse fixation usually emerges early in a person's life and refers to experiences in early relationships, often there is a particular scenario that must be compulsively reenacted and repeated in a particular way. Known as the perverse scene, it usually stems from a particularly arousing moment in one's biography. For example, the way a mother stroked her child's body with her stocking. The first physical manifestations of connection are often revealed in fetishes, the world of shapes and smells, tastes and touch. Quite often, fetishes share similar properties to skin, establish a skin relationship, against the skin, skin to skin, under the skin. Or the fetish becomes a secondary skin, like with a latex suit. This is about a state of complete physical unity, of oneness, a state that the fetish can recreate in controlled circumstances, over and over and over again. This element of bodily immediacy is also integral to voyeurism and exhibitionism, seeing, penetrating the sphere of the other with one's gaze, being seen, being touched by the gaze of the other. Sadism and masochism are no different. Penetrating, getting below the skin, making oneself felt in the other, dissolving into blood. However, these manifestations of perversion are surely much more complex and merit individual analysis. So perhaps perversion can be said to be, at its core, an early form of inseparability. One might characterize it as an inability to separate, in the more literal and physical sense. This may be because more mature kinds of relationships were blocked or fraught with conflict, or perhaps disrupted by trauma. Like an addict, perversion clings to something that it cannot move beyond. At the same time, it neutralizes the object of desire by reducing it to a mere thing with no life of its own. Something that is meaningful only insofar as it satisfies one's own sexual arousal. So sex is not really what this is all about. With perversion, sexual arousal is rather a deep and regressive attachment, fixated on forms of pleasure stemming from early childhood that in turn block other types of sexual experience. Perversion is essentially a solution to an inner conflict. It is through this addictive sexual stimulation that inseparability is preserved, while at the same time allowing for a certain degree of freedom to be felt in other areas of life. One could also say, and this certainly doesn't only apply to perversion, that it is an attempt at self-healing, at using sex to make oneself whole. It is possible to have interpersonal relationships and live a normal life, albeit not without giving in to the perversion. Though often kept secret, it remains indispensable. A sexual fetish is, as the psychoanalyst Morgenthaler describes it, a seal in the ego. It secures the structure of the psyche while also making it rigid at the same time. If the perversion loses its grip, for instance, in the course of an analysis, it often leads to a state of profound depression, an inner void, a boundless sense of loss, the disappearance of an inner bond. Perversion could also be understood as a sexualized, manically addictive defense mechanism built into the psychological structure in order to ward off a devastating emptiness. Sometimes the perversion also serves as a means of coping with trauma, such as when the perverse scene does in fact point to some traumatic event in one's life, such as a sexualized reenactment of strangulation or hanging, which points back to the suicide of one's father. The overwhelming horror is linked to sexual arousal, which is then sexually, orgasmically relieved and neutralized. This is also a kind of self-healing, an attempt to heal the trauma through sexual stimulation. For a young child, fear, horror, and libidinous arousal are not so far apart, which may also tell us something about the deep psychology of the amusement park. This narrower, clinical form of perversion should in no way be equated with sexualized violence. Even though there may always be a certain aggressive dimension at its core, as we will hear later. For others, however, it may be harmless. The exception, of course, is when the perversion intrudes into the lives and private spaces of others, as with exhibitionism or voyeurism. With this form of perversion, the other person is not really being targeted as a person, but as an object to be used for a particular function, which admittedly doesn't make things any better for the victim. Exhibitionists, for example, are known to flee in panic if their female victim does not respond as expected, such as by having the presence of mind to simply behave like a real human being and not a predictable object. This is not the case with sadism, however, to which we will turn in a moment. In addition to the clinically narrower concept of perversion, a broader definition of perversion can also be found in the psychoanalytic literature. It is broader because it is not just about fetish perversions, but rather about a wider group of violent sexual behaviors. These conceptualizations, which were pioneered by Robert Stoller and Mervyn Glosser, are important for understanding why sexualized violence is so often, though by no means exclusively, committed by men. And for the issue of pedophilia, we will only be able to address it in passing. An important topic indeed, but one that we would like to take up in a different context. In this broader concept, the focus is less on a fetish than on the hostility that is directed towards the sexual object. In this case, what is perverse is the reversal or inversion of the meaning of sex. It is not a manifestation of love. Instead, it is, sometimes openly, sometimes covertly, a manifestation of hatred. One could also say that it involves the sexualization of hatred. In Stoller's words, perversity is the erotic form of hatred. The other person is made into an object, but not because all they are interested in is the fetish, but because humiliating, torturing, dehumanizing, and shaming the other person is experienced as pleasurable. These forms of sadistic or aggressive sexualization are widespread. So widespread that there is hardly a woman who has not encountered them in one way or another. For some men, humiliation, aggression, or torment are necessary for sexual arousal. And this is not restricted to the cliché of sadomasochistic equipment, horse costumes, torture devices, and whips. Take catcalling, for example, a form of public verbal harassment, shouting sexual innuendos at women, honking or whistling at them. One might think that this is about initiating contact, like with flirting, but that would involve both people. Male power is experienced as pleasure. The woman has no choice but to take it, while the men drive by protected by their car, feeling superior as men or within the group. The perpetrator is not afraid of retaliation because, and we say this with quotation marks, it's only a woman. Of course, this makes them all the more cowardly should someone confront them, or when bystanders speak up for the woman. Much of the time, such forms of sexual harassment involve similar kinds of dehumanization, whether verbal, virtual, or physical, such as dick pics, pictures of an erect penis sent digitally or anonymously to women, but also aggressive groping, flirting, touching, as well as even worse forms of sexualized violence. Here, gestures of tenderness, touch, intimacy, and love are perverted in order to aggressively invade the space of someone else. Dick pics are a form of symbolic penetration, if you will. The man penetrating the woman's domain with an image of his penis. And at least in his fantasy, she has to submit. She is forced to look and is unable to defend herself, like in the phrase, to slide into someone's DMs. As is common in some very popular rap songs, devaluing and dehumanizing women or degrading them to a sexual commodity is essentially a statement of seemingly potent masculinity. and in this way of staging hyperpotency. The sexualization of aggression is commonplace. Such developments could be interpreted as evidence of the deterioration and vulgarization not only of everyday social conduct, but also of sex itself. In this respect, the staggering volume of pornography consumption, which amounts to a large share of overall traffic on the internet, perhaps speaks for itself, even if it is, of course, not the same as actual sexual assault. And yet, in many cases, pornography is perhaps itself a manifestation of how sex has been perverted by humiliation. In mainstream pornography, the woman is an object that has been primed and dehumanized for male lust. As a human subject, she is of no value. The manic exhibition of stimulated lust, the paradigmatic porno moan, may perhaps only be about easing the viewer's conscience, or about reaffirming the woman's identification with her role as a humiliated object. That's exactly how she wants it. Sexual aggression, up to and including outright sadism, seeks to penetrate an unwilling object until it can no longer defend itself, and then, overwhelmed by the aggressor's forcefulness, consent to being overpowered, moaning with pleasure. This is perhaps the overt or covert sadistic scene of many pornographic films. Such depictions of sex are not subtle about the hostility and aggression directed at women, at times becoming extremely explicit, as in so-called gangbangs, even including bloodshed. What is striking is that this is very much a male form of sexuality. It seems that there is a kind of continuum of male sexual arousal that tends towards aggression. And while it is mostly confined to fantasy or pornography, it does not seem entirely unrelated to the sexualized violence or the sexual tendencies at the extremes. Is perversity an inherent feature of male sexuality in general? Here, one should be very careful. It may be that sex in general always has an element of aggression and vulgarity inscribed within it, for both sexes. Perhaps sex that exists exclusively in the name of love is a lofty ideal, and perhaps also a little boring. Besides, love, attachment, sexuality, and aggression are not as clearly distinct, even neurobiologically, as the conceptual labels suggest. Most men can very well distinguish between dirty sex, which gives pleasure to both partners, and sexual assault. Although sex has a raw, animalistic dimension, even sadomasochistic elements, it is also part of loving. One's own desire does not have to replace the other person's point of view, their well-being, their own desire. Sex can be experienced as something shared, as a form of relating. It may be helpful to say that the threshold to aggressive forms of perversion is crossed only when this kind of interaction is no longer possible, when pleasure can only be experienced in extremes, when the other person must be penetrated violently, when the other person's will must be disregarded and broken. On the whole, however, the sexual encounter between a man and a woman presents a problem for male identity, a problem that we already heard about in episode 14 on the Oedipus complex, and which we will only briefly outline here. Male gender identity is oftentimes more precarious than female gender identity. It must free itself from a primary identification with the maternal, and yet desire continues to link it to the feminine, at least in heterosexual development. This means that the potential conflation of erotic femininity with maternal femininity always poses a threat to male identity. From the male perspective, this is a conflict between being a lover and being a mama's boy. Here, making love tenderly, surrendering, being seduced, and showing weakness are all potentially at odds with being male, having a sense of self, and being separate from one's mother. There is always something about the sphere of the feminine that is longed for, desired, magnificent, but also something that is feared, overpowering, something that threatens to subsume male identity precisely because it is the feminine that he so desires. Just like a little boy who is so in love with his mother. The psychoanalyst Mervyn Glasser referred to this as the core complex of male identity. The feminine is that which is both desired and feared at the same time. As the culminating point of fulfillment and ecstasy, but also annihilation and the loss of the ego. The more fragile the solution is here, the more fragile the male identity is as well, and the greater the need to find a particular way to stabilize and demonstrate one's male identity and potency. As the saying goes, inside every macho man there is a deep and complicated bond to the mother, whereby this is not always only about the biological mother, but anything that represents the maternal or the feminine. Achieving a more mature male identity usually involves being able to accept and express aspects of one's own personality that are feminine and tender, so that there is no conflict between being a man and being a tender lover. If, on the other hand, the boy was not able to find his way out of this feminine sphere, for example, because he was excessively dominated or even narcissistically abused by maternal figures, he may react by becoming hyper-masculine, responding aggressively to femininity because it threatens his identity. Certain circumstances in a person's life can deepen this inner dilemma, this core complex. For example, if the maternal sphere is experienced as invasive by the boy at an early age, if the mother herself cannot differentiate between son and lover, if the father is distant, absent, or weak, and no other forms of fatherhood are available to compensate, or as a result of sexual trauma that tears down the boundaries of one's own identity, one's own body, or because of a prevailing lack of connection, in which the child and its desires are left helpless and powerless. The hatred of that which one actually loves, or at least that which one cannot separate oneself from, is what ultimately manifests itself in aggressive sexual acts. In other words, the sexualization of violence is a compromise between destructive hatred and existential dependency. Perversity that tends towards sadism, especially in the case of overt sadism, clings to the object of its violence like a libidinal addict. Often, this inner conflict surfaces in the form of a schism between an idealized mother or woman, about whom never a bad word may be spoken, and a despised, debased woman who can be exploited in any way, between the saint and the whore. In fact, behind almost every kind of idealization, there is a hidden devaluation, something that should also be kept in mind in therapeutic processes. When social circumstances are sufficiently peaceful, sexualized violence would normally only result from some severe personal trauma or intense inner conflict. But given the particular dynamics within characteristically masculine groups, gangs, soldiers, in-groups, and especially in situations of social enemy, there arises a potential for these inner tendencies to be unleashed. Tendencies that appear to be structurally ingrained in many men. The hostility of sexual perversity inverts one's own feelings of dependency and inferiority and transforms them into sexual triumph. A sexual triumph with a strong potential for addiction and extremes, to subjugate the almighty feminine, break her, conquer her with this hyperpotent phallus. Into every hole, in every conceivable way, the way a man wants it. At the same time, to merge with the hated and desired feminine, fuse with her. To put it more graphically, tear her open and thrust himself in. In essence, this amounts to using sex as a narcissistic transvaluation of powerlessness, which itself has less to do with sex in the narrow sense than with a narcissistic wound. At its core, this is about the fear of connection, the inability to have real intimacy with another person. to surrender oneself through sexual intimacy, to open oneself up, or to use the euphemism for sex from the Bible, to know the other person fully so as to be fully known. This may explain the popularity of shows about women who are naive, weak, inferior, without any personality of their own, such as the common trope of the attractive teen, desirable and sweet, who must be completely pure, smooth, without an ounce or a hair of originality. Anything that might offend or express too much feminine power. Some cases of pedophilic violence, though not all, may have their origins here, which is not a desire for children per se, but about being able to inflict all kinds of sadism on a defenseless object, about transforming one's own smallness and powerlessness into omnipotent power. In extreme cases, to allow the monstrous to come out. Again, this has nothing to do with sex. It is rather a perversion of sexual arousal in service of destructive narcissism. In the forms of perversion and perversity outlined so far, there is a potential for sexualized violence, though not always. Or to put it another way, not all sexualized violence can be attributed to perversity and perversion. As we heard in episode 20, such violence can also be related to the psychology of trauma, for example, as a form of transgenerational trauma, or to problems of impulse control, personality disorders, or psychopathy, or arise out of certain group dynamics, or simply envy. But in the final analysis, the field of sexuality is also just too broad and complex to be reduced to general formulas and rules. And the particular meaning of every individual perversion can never be explained in a general theory. But there is perhaps one principle that does hold true for sexuality in all of its many shapes and forms. Ultimately, true fulfillment can only ever come from love, never from hate. This podcast is written and produced by Cecile Lutz and Jakob Müller, translated and read by Solomon Lawrence.